National Infertility Awareness Week. And I am joined by the one and only Dr. Lucky Sekhon at lucky.sekhon, S-E-K-H-O-N, here on Instagram. We've done a lot of things together. And so we came up with a list of questions that you guys submitted. And then some things that Dr. Sekhon wanted to talk about. So it's kind of like a hodgepodge of some things that maybe we haven't discussed before, but some new things as well. You ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Okay. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is what you mentioned to me, and that is what's called IVF add-ons, which I had never heard it called that before. I know what it is, but I guess it has a term. So what exactly does IVF add-ons mean?
So it's basically this group of treatments that in my mind I lump together as being things that aren't essential. They're not the core part of IVF, which is stimulating the ovaries, extracting the eggs, making embryos, doing an embryo transfer. It is, you know, extra testing or interventions that most of all haven't been proven in high quality studies, which are randomized controlled trials. And you know, there isn't robust data behind them. And I think it's hard because IVF is a very new field of medicine in the 70s off in the last couple of decades and has improved success rates because it's a fast moving, growing technology. We're learning new things every day. And you always see the pendulum swinging from one direction to the next. You know, like a lot of people will jump on the bandwagon anytime there's a new shiny gadget or test or tool. And sometimes it turns out to be really helpful and it's shown in the data to be helpful. Sometimes we falls off of that bandwagon and moves on to the next thing. So we all want to have tools in our toolkit. And I think it's, you know, important to strike a balance between trying new things but you have to balance it with not increasing the burden of treatment on patients, driving up the cost of their treatment. And some of these things might have harmful, you know, unintended consequences or side effects. So, you know, this is a broad category that can refer to things like endometrial scratching, which is, you know, doing a biopsy to induce some healthy inflammation in the cycle preceding a transfer. And that was actually proven in a large randomized control study to not be helpful. And so most people who were initially excited about it stopped doing it. But I still get asked about it. And I think there still are clinics and doctors that are offering it or using it as a routine part of their protocol. And that just extends the treatment. And we have good data that shows it's not helpful. And it's a biopsy. It is invasive. It's probably not dangerous, but you know, I just think that there needs to be a good reason to do things like that. The ERA test is another hot topic that everyone keeps talking about. It's another biopsy of the lining, and they look at gene expression markers, and it's supposed to be informative and tell you if you need less hours or more hours of progesterone leading up to your transfer. And I just feel like that's a huge thing to change based on a test that went almost straight to market after very small studies with very small numbers of patients. So I just think we need more data. The ERA in particular is a hot topic because, you know, it was initially thought of as being this test that can improve outcomes in people with recurrent implantation failure. And that's what it was really marketed towards. But now a lot of people are doing it preemptively before a first transfer. And a recent randomized controlled trial came out where they looked at that and showed no improvement in live birth rates and people doing this before their first transfer. So it's not something that I recommend.
Yeah. So it's kind of like the post that I made a few days ago about the whole thing with one study doesn't mean it's so. Just because something comes out, it sounds new and exciting, doesn't mean we should start doing it, especially when it comes to something like fertility and IVF protocols, because unless we have some good data that it's going to show that it helps. And I think a lot of times people think, well, if it's not going to hurt, then why not? But over time, we develop that data. When you're thinking about the process of IVF, the financial, the emotional, the physical investment and all that, we would really need to have some data behind that. So it's important to still ask those questions about these IVF add-ons. And you touched on a few of them, but I want to just we'll go through a list of them and you just tell me what you think real quickly. Acupuncture.
Sure. So acupuncture, I think for some people, it really improves their quality of life. You know, it relaxes them.
That's what it did for me.
Yeah. And I love falling asleep on the table. It's like a great feeling. it's not harmful. There's no study out there that shows that it can detract from your outcomes. So if you enjoy it and you like it, do it. If you don't enjoy it, if it's breaking the bank for you, you can't get it covered by your insurance, and it's stressing you out, then leave it, because there isn't really robust data to suggest that it's going to make or break your cycle.
So I think if anything, for me at least, and at least from what I can tell from the data, it helps, if anything, with the stress aspect.
Yes.
And I think it's what happened, but I don't think it changed my uterus or my blood flow or anything like that. I think it was more for me just to help with the stress factor. Now, this is a hot topic. Pre-implantation genetic testing for aneuploidy. Now, let's go briefly through the different types of PGT, because there are different types, right?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes.
What are the different ones?
The main one is PGT-A, which stands for aneuploidy, which is a fancy way of saying an embryo with the wrong number of chromosomes. That's the number one way that it's used across the board. And if there's anything specialized being tested, it's always going to be counting the number of chromosomes, because that's a human problem. It's universal. Mm-hmm. Anyone can make an embryo with the wrong number of chromosomes. Mm-hmm. And even if you're 20, that can happen to 20 to 25% percent of your embryos. But there's additional testing that you can do. There's PGT-M, which stands for monogenic disorders. So let's say you and a partner both carry the cystic fibrosis mutation. You know that there's a 1 in 4 chance of having an embryo or a child with 2 copies, the actual disease. You can actually hone in and look for a certain set of mutations in the embryos. And that's a very specialized form of PGT. There's usually prep required where they build a specialized probe to look for that specific illness that you're screening for. Then there's PGT-SR, that's structural rearrangements, and that's to look for specifically embryos that might be affected by something called a translocation or inversion, where there's sections of DNA in the chromosomes and the way they're formed that are flipped or rearranged. And even though it doesn't cause a problem for the parent that has that rearrangement because they have all their genes, it can cause problems when their genes combine with their partner's genes, and there's a higher than expected proportion of abnormal embryos that form. And then you can do PGT for reasons of HLA matching, which is really rare. And I've actually never had a case of that in my career yet. Those are really the main forms.
Right. But it's important. I mean, it's good to know that there are different forms. And like Dr. Seekon said, the main one that we all probably know about is PGT-A, which is what I had with all my embryos because of my age. So that's the one that most people, I think what most people don't understand is the difference between PGT-A versus the PGT-SR, because we know we can do the PGT-A and get the numbers of chromosomes. It can tell you if you have the right numbers or you're having extra chromosomes or missing one within the different pairs. But then the PGT-SR looks within translocations with each one of those chromosomes. So that's how it's a little bit different. And usually for the PGT-SR, it's if there's a known, someone, one of the partners is a known carrier for a translocation, correct?
Yes. And that's something that you can pick up in a karyotype. And that's a test that we is specialized. It's, a lot of people will assume, I did all my genetic testing. One should consider doing our expanded carrier screening. And that's looking at both prospective parents and seeing what mutations, if any, they carry. We all carry mutations. It doesn't matter because you usually have at least one functional copy of a gene. And that's to figure out if there's any risk of you matching for any of those mutations and having a child with 2 copies. That's different than a karyotype. Your doctor's only going to order a karyotype for specific reasons, usually recurrent pregnancy loss. If you did an IVF cycle and nothing turned into an embryo and you're young and that doesn't make sense, that's another reason to do a karyotype.
Okay, you already talked about endometrial scratching. What about adding growth hormone to an IVF protocol?
I mean, it's something that is regarded as experimental. It's not like an accepted treatment that is known to improve outcome of ovarian stimulation.
But what is it supposed to do? What is the purpose of it?
People think that it can help patients with a low response, a low ovarian reserve, patients who are older. They think that it provides some sort of boost to the way the ovaries respond and improves egg quality, but there's really no good data that shows that. And growth hormone can have some adverse side effects and outcomes. So And in some states, it's actually considered illegal to use it, you know, if it's not indicated for its actual purpose, which is, you know, supplementing people that have a growth hormone deficiency. So, you know, in New York State, you're not supposed to be using it for that purpose. So we don't use it at our clinic.
Gotcha. Okay. Next would be assisted hatching. What is it and what do we know about it?
So assisted hatching is something that I think it's confusing because it used to be done on embryos to try to assist with implantation, make them more likely to implant. The embryo is in a shell that is inherited from the egg called the zona pellucida. And so the idea was, well, if we drill a hole into it or we digest it and thin it out with enzymes, perhaps it'll make the embryo more likely to implant. And that's really old-fashioned. And now the only reason we think about doing assisted hatching in the lab is if we're doing a biopsy to test the embryos genetically, we need a certain number of cells to kind of herniate out. And it's almost helpful if the embryo's a little bit hatched. So we might do laser-assisted hatching on day 3, and sometimes people do it on day 5 to help with the biopsy. And that's the only real reason to do it.
Gotcha. Now, some of the other things that someone was asking about steroid, like adding steroids or prednisolone to the IVF cycle. What about that?
So there is a great ASRM committee opinion, or actually it's a task force document, and I was part of creating that. It took 2 years to review all of the literature, and we were all assigned to different things. I believe I was assigned to steroids and baby aspirin. So I've looked at all the literature for this, and the truth is, we know the immune system plays a huge role in implantation, right? It's very complex. You need your immune system to dampen and become slightly immune, relatively immunosuppressed in order for your body to accept an implanting embryo, which is at least half of it's foreign, right? Because it's coming from someone else, whoever contributed the sperm. And so we know the immune system plays this permissive role. So there's this idea that, okay, well, people who are having problems with implantation, perhaps their immune system is rejecting this embryo. So if we dampen their immune response further by giving them prednisone and steroids and IVIG, immunoglobulins, intralipids, we mess with their immune system, and hopefully we'll tweak it in because there really are no good ways to test. There's no immune markers that are known to really tell us what's going on. Like, we know the immune system is important, but it's a major blind spot for us because I could run a bunch of immune markers and not really know what that means.
You're
And
right.
there are a lot of reproductive immunologists, which is kind of a field that's just been created where, people have looked at the different studies and they come up with their own cocktail. And, they'll take you in, they'll charge you to do a bunch of testing, and they'll give you a very detailed report. And I can't really comment on it because the data just doesn't point to some standardized method or approach. So, have I had patients who, out of desperation after several failed cycles, have decided, they want to try prednisone, they want to go on steroids? I don't administer a lot of these things, but sometimes they'll seek a second opinion. And you know what? I'm going to be open-minded, but I always tell them this is what the data shows. And they're it's not completely inconsequential to be messing with your immune system either. Like, how do you know it's not dampening the response too much? Like, there's a healthy level of inflammation, right? Because that's what the endometrial scratch is based on. So it's just, it's kind of like the blind leading the blind in this area, and it's frustrating because we know it's important. We just need to learn more about it.
Yeah, so it kind of sounds like some of the things with NAPRO technology where they're supposed to look at what type, how the hormones are supposed to affect you individually, and there's no science behind it at all. It's a money-making thing. People do it with progesterone for preterm labor, and there's nothing, that says it works at all. So just be wary. And I understand because I've been in that situation. I understand the desperation. You've tried so many things and you're willing to try anything. I just want to take the moment, and I've said this before with both Dr. Lee Sikon on Lives and other fertility specialists. You have to trust your fertility specialist. That is the number one person that you should go to. If you feel like you're starting to look into the fertility groups, you're starting asking questions, you're starting to wander outside, then there's something going on with that relationship there, and it might not be the right relationship. And sometimes you have to find the right connection for you with your fertility specialist, and you might need to get a second opinion. But your fertility specialist should know what you're doing and what you're seeking and what you're trying out. And if you feel like you can't tell them because you're afraid of what they might say, then that's even more of a sign that something is going on. So it's really important that you have that relationship with your fertility specialist. Do we you t mentioned aspirin for IVF along with the prednisolone. What about the aspirin?
So baby aspirin is actually indicated if you know that someone has antiphospholipid syndrome, right? Some patients come to me with recurrent pregnancy loss and we find that those markers are elevated. And we put them on baby aspirin while they're trying to conceive. And if they get pregnant, then we put them on Lovenox. And that's a proven intervention. Sometimes I'll have patients that want to go on baby aspirin during a transfer cycle in an effort to improve blood flow to the uterus. The data does not show any benefit,
No.
but I feel a lot better about that than people just willy-nilly taking Lovenox, which is a much more
Yeah.
potent anticoagulant, which I
Yes.
worry about doing things like that
Yes.
with no reason. What if you fall and hit your head or get in a car accident? It's going to produce a much more precarious situation where you're going to
Even
bleed more than you should.
the lower doses, and I've heard of patients getting it from other countries as well. And I will say, you do not know what you're getting when you're getting it from other countries. You don't. You don't know that dosage is the right way. And that's, and I've seen it happen a lot in my pregnant patients. I'm not a fertility specialist, but I've seen it on the other end. So be very careful about doing anything like that. I wanted to ask you about embryo glue.
Yeah, that's not a thing. I mean, it was looked at a long time ago, and it was one of those things that became like a craze, but it never stuck around. No pun intended. But I've heard of people still doing it and talking about it. So the point is that this is an area that's highly unregulated. And it's kind of like the Wild West. Like, and you know, I hate to say this about my field because we've done so much that's good, but there's also a lot of gray areas. And I think it's because it's human nature to want to be the fixer and to have multiple tools in our toolkit. And I think that that is a very natural tendency, but we have to be honest and say when things, you know, are actually rooted in evidence.
I 100% agree with that. Absolutely agree with that. Okay, I want to move on to a recent Instagram reel. Now, I did not get to read the article, and I will, but I didn't have time to read it, about that the New York Times published about, what was it? It's, and I copied down your caption. It said that the article presented, it was talking about a recent study in human reproduction, and they presented it saying that pre-implantation genetic testing, or PGTA, identified embryos as fully abnormal in 8 cases of healthy live birth. But in actuality, the large majority of live births in the study were achieved from the transfer of mosaic embryos, not abnormal. So what does that mean?
Right. So going back to our discussion about PGTA, when you get your results back, people think it's going to be normal or abnormal, but there's actually four different possibilities. You could have abnormal, where there's missing chromosomes or extra chromosomes. They can even tell you if pieces are missing or are gained. That's very clear cut. You're not going to use those embryos. There's normal that have 46 chromosomes. You can use that embryo. And then there's two kind of in-between results. One is indeterminate, where the DNA didn't amplify. There was some sort of technical issue. It doesn't mean anything about your embryo. It could be completely fine. We just don't have the confidence to make a call one way or the other. And in that case, you could rebiopsy your embryo or you could just transfer it blindly, right? And then there's this fourth option, which is called a mosaic. And that is another in-between result, but it's a known biological phenomenon where you can have an embryo that has more than one cell line running through it. Some of us can be mosaics and never even know about it because we didn't do a karyotype, right? And basically, a mosaic embryo, some of their cells are normal. In the sample that's taken from the embryo, it's a few cells of the part that becomes the placenta. It's biopsied and sent off for analysis. So what they've detected is there was a mixture of normal and abnormal cells. Some of the cells had 46 chromosomes, some had some other number that was not normal. So when we first found out about this was 2016, because the technology has evolved for the way we count the number of chromosomes in that biopsy sample from the embryo. And the resolution has improved to allow us to understand whether there's a mixture. Before it was just, we had a threshold, and if you were above the threshold, it was normal. If it was below, it's abnormal. Now, what did we do with this information? Well, initially, everyone was afraid. They thought, well, this is not a normal embryo because there are some abnormal cells in it. We also know if you look at pediatric data, there are known issues like neurodevelopmental problems, even cases of autism that have been linked to children that are known to be mosaic and have some sort of chromosomal error in a few of their cells or some of their cells. So we thought, okay, we're not going to transfer these. And then, you know, we've studied this now where there have been large case series and multi-center studies where people have, with patient consent under a research protocol, transferred mosaic embryos. And now we've gathered enough data over the last 5 to 7 years to feel more confident to offer the opportunity to transfer a mosaic embryo to patients, because we know that mosaic embryos can result in seemingly healthy live births. We don't have long-term data because this has only come to light since 2016. But in reality, whenever you're doing a fresh transfer without PGT, or when we were using the older technology that didn't have that high resolution, we were probably transferring mosaics all the time. Now, what we learned from the studies are that mosaic embryos, when transferred, have a lower chance of implanting. That makes sense, because some of them are probably going to be truly abnormal eventually. As the embryo grows and develops, the abnormal cells take over, and maybe that's the majority of the embryo, right? There's a higher risk of miscarriage with mosaic embryos that are transferred. And we know that, so far, the live births that we've had, the overwhelming majority of those babies had normal genetic testing on like a cheek swab. Now, does that mean they're not mosaic in other parts of their body that we can't detect? No. But it is encouraging. And like I said, we don't have long-term outcome data of what, their health is at age 10 or 20, but that data will be accumulated. So there are unknowns. There's an uneasiness there, but most clinics are offering this as an option now. At my clinic, we'll be supportive of the transfer of a mosaic embryo if it's your only embryo and you can't make more, and that's not feasible for you, and you've been well counseled by a genetic counselor. So the issue with going back, now that I've given you the background on mosaics, the issue with that paper was it was splashed across the New York Times. It was published in Human Reproduction, which is a huge journal. And both the headline and the title of the article and the abstract made it seem like this clinic took all these abnormal, truly abnormal embryos and just started transferring them to prove that PGT is not valid, that you're only seeing a subset of the cells, and that they had 8 live births. And it was 144 embryos that were transferred. So that's not even good, right? 8 live births out of 144. But the fact that there were that many errors in the PGT results, that's what it looked like. When you actually look at the list of live births, 6 out of 8 were mosaic embryo transfers. One of them was from a time and with a lab that wasn't reporting mosaicism at that time. So it could have been mosaic, we don't know. And only one was fully abnormal. And that is consistent with the error rate. PGT is a test like any other. It is very accurate, but there still is a chance for error, and it's less than 2%. 1 out of 144 is a pretty good error rate to me. So I think it was just a case of, misconstruing data and making people feel really nervous. And, I can't even tell you how many DMs I got, so I had to address it.
Oh, I can imagine. There was a recent one, a study about the COVID vaccination in pregnancy that was taken from, it wasn't even a study, it was just from looking at a database, and it had no study design or anything, but it was all over all the major news outlets, and everybody was freaking out. And I really hate it because I know the New York Times is a good source. I mean, it typically is. But all it takes is something like this, and then your faith is kind of just like, ugh. And so I feel the same way, because it's a huge source of information for people. And when they see something like that, they're thinking, well, are the doctors not telling us right? Are they not giving us all the options we should have? And
I
the
found it
simple
really
reality is,
disappointing.
yes. Yeah, no, it
I
is
find with
disappointing. And
women's health lately, like I feel like that's been the angle, is sensationalized headlines. And I feel like they did it with the non-invasive prenatal testing one as well. It was just like, yeah, so I don't
Well,
know.
actually, and SMFM just came out with something more about that too, and I'll cover that eventually, about the non-invasive prenatal testing as a result, in response to that. So,
Good.
but it's a never-ending thing, and it's why people like myself and you are here constantly trying to battle these myths and this crap that's on social media and even in the news media now. And we just have to keep doing what we're doing. So that's why we're here. Okay, let's move on to the next one. And this is a good question because it actually pertains to me, or pertain to me. How can I prepare my body for an embryo adoption slash donor transfer?
Yeah, so this is maybe a boring answer, but be the healthiest version of yourself, right? So start with all of the different elements of lifestyle. The best diet, because I get asked this all the time, there is no magic bullet, there's no magic superfood, is a Mediterranean style diet, but that's the best diet for cardiovascular health,
For
right?
everyone, yeah.
Yeah, lean proteins, avoiding processed foods, healthy fats, eating the rainbow, anything high in antioxidants. So trying to just take a 360 approach to this lifestyle-wise, I think is a good place to start. Getting into a routine with cardiovascular exercise regularly, like 30 to 40 minutes, 3 to 4 times per week, that's a good goal. If you have an unhealthy high BMI, work towards reducing that because that's going to set you up for a healthier pregnancy and it's going to improve the chance of your transfer working. And, it's just going to improve the environment of your body. Getting off of any medications that might be dangerous in pregnancy. So if you have any chronic health conditions, definitely checking in with your specialist, making sure that they're talking to your fertility doctor and, that your doctor who's managing the transfer is aware of any changes in protocol that might be required. I think, managing any of the regular health surveillance things, like being on top of your Pap smears, mammograms, colonoscopy, if it applies. If you have a strong family history of cancer, you might want to engage in some of this surveillance earlier on than what is typically recommended. And I say this because once you're pregnant, our treatment options are limited. And in cases where you find a cancer during pregnancy, it can be very devastating because it can delay your ability to get treatment. And then you can make really hard decisions because of that. So, just making sure that everything checks out with your health, really taking a moment to go through that checklist in your mind is going to be the best way to prepare for a transfer. I think also from a mental health standpoint, making sure that you are really trying to remove the stressors in your life. Obviously, you can't live in a bubble, but give yourself a little bit of space and grace. And if you have crazy deadlines or a really bad time of the year coming up, like maybe you want to plan your transfer to not fall right during that time. When you know your career and your work is going to be crazy. And I think really mobilizing your support network and, if you are in therapy, like maybe setting up extra appointments around that time when you know you might be stressed, especially during the 2 week wait. So those are just some things that are top of mind that I would think of in preparation.
And adding on to that, the one thing that I wish I had done that I didn't do was start therapy. I should have been seeing a therapist through the whole process because I think that would have helped me manage things a lot better. And I didn't do that until a few years after. So that's the one big piece of advice as someone who's been through this. And then it then ended up conceiving via donor egg. And not that the donor egg was what was stressing me, it's just the whole fertility, everything for the 2 years I was going through it. But definitely your mental health is a huge, it's so important to manage. And I want to say this, if you need to be on some form of medication to control, if you have a pre-existing mental health disorder, anxiety, depression, and you need the medication to control it, take the medication. Even if you're going through fertility, even if you're in the first trimester of pregnancy, because the outcomes of potentially adverse outcomes of not taking it and dealing with the depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, anything that you have, are potentially worse or likely worse than actually taking the medication. So I see with people going through fertility treatments and then early pregnancy, you want to stop everything and then they get uncontrolled mental health disorder or whatever they had pre-existing. And that's not what we want. It's not going to be beneficial for your fertility journey or your pregnancy. So it's okay to take those medications if you need them.
I think
But I
people
do agree with,
underestimate like the toll that it can take, and they overestimate their ability to cope. Like everyone, and
absolutely.
I'm guilty of this too. You always bite off more than you can chew. And I think it's good to be real with yourself and just, even if you don't need the extra help, just over prepare because that can always come out handy in the end.
Exactly. Okay, let's talk about unexplained infertility. I kind of feel I want to ask you what the definition is, but I want to start by saying unexplained fertility, probably in your field, is a little bit similar to when I had to tell someone I don't know why they're having pregnancy loss. Because everybody wants an answer. And I get that. You want to have an answer because if you have an answer, you then hopefully there's something that you could do to fix it. But unfortunately, there's unexplained infertility and there's unexplained pregnancy loss, unexplained recurrent pregnancy loss. And we don't always get answers. So speaking of unexplained infertility, what exactly does that mean? And then what percentage of your of infertility cases are due to unexplained infertility?
Yeah, so unexplained doesn't mean that there isn't an actual explanation. It's just we don't have the tools to get to the bottom of it. Usually, broad strokes, it means the HSG was normal, so your tubes are not blocked. Your uterine cavity doesn't have any known issues like a fibroid or a polyp in the inner lining that could be taking away surface area from where an embryo would want to implant. And the semen analysis is normal, so it doesn't seem to be a sperm issue from the limited testing that we can do. But we can't get as nitty-gritty as we would like to. We don't know how to test for egg quality, so that's a huge blind spot. We make assumptions based on age, and any good doctor knows that you can't really reduce a patient down to a category or a number based on something written on a piece of paper, but that's the best that we can do. And, even sperm quality, yes, the concentration and how it swims and how it's shaped can tell you a lot, but does it tell you about things like DNA fragmentation? And the testing that we currently have for DNA fragmentation is controversial because, some studies have shown it's not always reproducible. And, we just don't really understand how valid it is. So you can't get, you can't know everything there is to know. And some of the cases of unexplained might be things like endometriosis that, you might not really put across in your history of, okay, did you have painful periods? Well, you've lived with these periods your whole life. So a lot of times women with endometriosis might not recognize the signs or symptoms, and sometimes it can be really subtle, but that can cause infertility in a good chunk of cases of unexplained infertility. So there's a lot of things that really can't be seen with the untrained eye or even with testing with the trained eye, and that's what we're lumping in as one thing, unexplained. And that's why the main treatment at the very least is doing things on both ends, both the egg end and the sperm end, taking medication to give your body the chance to release more than one egg, things like Clomid or letrozole, and in some cases, injectable medications, and doing an insemination where you're washing the sperm, concentrating it, and injecting it closer to where the eggs are being released. Because if you just focus on one or the other, that's not going to be very effective. Studies have actually shown that. Really well-designed studies, large-scale studies in multiple centers have shown that. So it's really the combination of the two to be efficient because you don't really know what you're treating.
And then what percentage would you say, or is there, do we know, have a percentage
Yeah,
that, that
we
would
normally say 15%.
15, okay, or due to
Yeah.
unexplained infertility.
Yeah.
Okay. Here is another question. What causes recurrent pregnancy loss after 35? I will start by saying, obviously the two main things you think about recurrent pregnancy loss, and I just did a live discussion previously, the one before this one, about recurrent pregnancy loss. If you want to go
Right.
get more information on that, is as you start getting past 35, 37, 40, one of the more common causes could be genetic abnormalities in the embryo, because,
Right.
Dr. Sigan's already talked about this. But their recurrent pregnancy loss after 35 could be to any of the other things that could cause recurrent pregnancy loss in anyone, which would be
Right.
what?
Like structural abnormalities inside the uterus. You could be born with a septum, which is like a little wall in the center of the uterus, and it's kind of dividing the cavity in half and doesn't have a lot of blood supply. And oftentimes embryos can find that surface and implant. And then when there isn't a blood supply, eventually it can cause a first trimester loss. That is more common than people think, actually, because they're like, well, my GYN did a scan on me and never mentioned this because your uterus is a collapsed cavity. And when we're looking at it from a side profile view, you don't always see something like that. So unless you're putting fluid inside the uterus to push the walls apart, you're not always going to get that view. So it could be a septum. That's what I'm talking about. Could be other structural issues like scar tissue, fibroids in the lining, polyps. It could be blood clotting issues like antiphospholipid syndrome, which, if you take blood thinners, that can help prevent future pregnancy losses. And I do pick that up a fair number of the time. Like I wouldn't say that it's rare. It could be, like you said, genetics, but related to something like having a translocation or something wrong with your structure of your chromosomes or your partner's, where it's not an issue for you, but it leads to a much higher than anticipated rate of genetic errors in the embryos that are created. And so those are really the main things. There could also be hormonal disturbances. There's some data suggesting that high prolactin levels can throw off you know, the way that your hormones are supposed to be secreted from your pituitary gland, and that in turn could lead to lower progesterone levels that aren't able to support the pregnancy after implantation. Having, you know, deranged thyroid function, having uncontrolled diabetes, those are other examples of hormonal disorders.
I just had a patient not too long ago who was in her late 20s, but had had multiple losses, was a type 1 diabetic. No doc had ever told her that it was from her diabetes, and it likely was because she was uncontrolled. And I'm not sure there's a hesitation, there was a hesitation for whatever physicians were managing them before, but I think that's, you know, some of the things like diabetes, thyroid disease, can cause not necessarily recurrent pregnancy loss, but can cause pregnancy loss if it's uncontrolled. So that's why having your any chronic medical conditions that you have is so important for fertility. And, you know, even having cardiac disease that requires medications or uncontrolled hypertension or anything like that, it's so important to get those medical conditions as well controlled as possible once you decide to try to conceive, because it can affect your fertility, even though people intuitively think it doesn't, it wouldn't make any difference, but it definitely can. So yeah, I see that a lot. I see that a lot with the diabetes and other chronic medical conditions, for sure.
And then, more recently in the pandemic, there has been some data on COVID infection and miscarriage, which is not something that was initially apparent. So it makes sense. I mean, if you're, if your body is undergoing significant amounts of inflammation and your immune system is involved, it can affect implantation.
Absolutely, yeah. There's definitely data on first trimester loss, and obviously anything after 20 weeks, I've discussed, and I just posted about it today, about the potential complications after 20 weeks. Okay, what's the next question? This is a good one. My fiance has no sperm. The doctor wants to do a biopsy. Is there anything else he can do or try before having that procedure? So I guess first, if someone has given a semen sample, I'm assuming this couple was having trouble conceiving. Let's say the partner gave a semen sample. There is azoospermia, right? With no sperm. And so the doc wants to do a biopsy. Is that typical to want to do a biopsy in that situation?
Yeah, I think this is so good that someone asked this question because I definitely am guilty of this. We don't talk about male infertility enough. We focus a lot on the female. So azoospermia is when there's no sperm. The concentration is, zero or very, very low. And it can be two main causes. One is obstructive, meaning the testes are producing sperm, it just can't get out, right? So you might have had a vasectomy. Obviously, that's, an induced cause. But sometimes people are born without a vas deferens because they carry the cystic fibrosis mutation. And sometimes there can be strictures or blockages if you've had certain surgeries in the past in that area. There can also be like a lack of ejaculation. So there's a lot of different reasons that can cause you not to be able to get the sperm, even though it's being produced, into the actual ejaculate.
And previous childhood viral illnesses like mumps can also cause that, correct?
Yes, so that's from inflammation of the testes. So we're talking obstructive causes, right?
Oh, okay.
There's
Yeah,
also,
right.
and then there's also problems with production, and that's called
Production.
non-obstructive. So obstructive is kind of easier to deal with because there are ways to just extract sperm. You can even aspirate the sperm with a needle. If it's being produced and it's normal, then you can just store it in vials and freeze it and use it however you need to. If it's non-obstructive, it means it's a production problem, and that's usually much more serious and difficult to treat. And it can have a variety of causes. It could be hormonal because the pituitary gland is just deficient and it's not sending signals to the testes to actually make testosterone and make sperm. It could be genetic. That's usually the most difficult thing. You can have Y chromosome microdeletions. I've seen patients who have problems with their karyotype where one of their chromosomes has an inversion, and that just happens to contain a lot of genes that are important for male fertility, which is so interesting. And, in some of these cases, the doctor could do a biopsy called a testicular sperm extraction or a TESE, and they might find sperm. Sometimes they're not going to find sperm. So it's a little bit tenuous. You don't know what you're in for until you go in, and you can get clues from the size of the testes on physical examination. From hormone markers, like those can give you ideas of whether it's a good prognosis or poor prognosis. And there are certain types of Y chromosome microdeletions. If you have an A or a B, that's actually terrible. So it's like the opposite of what you'd think, school grades wise. A C is actually great. because there's a chance you could find sperm. But if it's an A or B, we normally say just use donor sperm because we're literally not going to find anything. So a biopsy is oftentimes recommended. Oftentimes you're not going to get a lot of sperm, so we'll coincide the biopsy to happen on the day of the partner's egg retrieval, because we don't want to have to freeze the small amounts of sperm that we have. We're going to want to use them right then and there. So it's always important to have a backup plan. On the day of egg retrieval, what happens if the biopsy doesn't yield sperm? Is the backup plan to freeze the eggs? Do you want to have donor sperm on backup? A lot of patients, you know, they need to come to terms with it. So oftentimes the first step will be, let's just freeze the eggs. And if maybe they try the biopsy again and it doesn't work, or the pathology, because they'll usually send the tissue off for analysis, sometimes it'll show like this is a case that's associated with a specific condition and you're not ever going to get sperm, then you might thaw the eggs out and use them with donor sperm. It's a really difficult issue. And I definitely think that therapy and counseling should be undertaken by an individual going through this, or a couple going through this.
That's good. So the biopsy is to see if there's sperm there, not for a diagnosis?
To extract the sperm. No, it's to diagnose and therapeutic.
Oh, to both. Oh, both. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's why you would ideally wait to an egg retrieval in case there are sperm retrieved.
Yeah.
You could just automatically use them, right?
Yes. Instead of trying to freeze sperm that might be suboptimal and there might be very few of them.
Gotcha. I learned something. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Okay, chemical pregnancies or biochemical pregnancies. First, what is a biochemical pregnancy? I get a lot of, questions about this. I've done videos on it before, but what is a biochemical pregnancy?
It's basically an early miscarriage. It's an embryo that was beginning to implant, started secreting HCG, but never got past the point where you could actually see it inside the uterus. Mm-hmm. In order to be able to visualize a pregnancy, your HCG level has to be able to get to 1,000. Mm-hmm. Normally people say 1,500, but our machines at RMA are really good. Mm-hmm. So I say 1,000.
Yeah, really, yeah.
We should be able to see a sac, right? Mm-hmm. And so if your levels never got beyond that point because they got to 500 and then they started declining because the pregnancy started to, you know, stopped growing and stalled.
And biochemical pregnancies became more common because of the use of IVF, because of following the HCG levels, right?
100%.
Yeah, tracking. Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A lot of times they go unrecognized. Someone asked me this the other day when I was doing a Q&A, how do I know if I've ever had one? You don't. I mean, there are some clues, but it can be hard to decipher because not every delayed period or really heavy period is because you're having a biochem. I'll have patients sometimes come to me and say, I had a biochemical pregnancy. I'm like, did you ever take a pregnancy test? And they're like, no, but my boobs were
period
was
late. Yeah.
And I'm like,
I know. I get it too. Yeah. And I teach the residents and medical students, and you're interviewing with someone and they tell you they have, you know, this number of pregnancy losses. I go through every pregnancy loss because it's important for me to know, you know, was it a biochemical? Did they ever see a sac? Did they ever see a heartbeat? You know, how far along they were. And so many times they'll say, well, my period was late, but I felt like I was pregnant and I had a positive pregnancy test. But, you know, so all of that helps me determine, I'm sure you as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, what exactly was going on, because technically for recurrent pregnancy loss or a diagnosis or a workup of potential recurrent pregnancy loss, we don't include biochemicals. And that's just because again, they're so early. That they're not considered to be part of what's would be included in a recurrent pregnancy loss workup. But like we just mentioned, because of the use of IVF and, you know, obviously tracking ACGs, we're going to see a lot more of those.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. And because of the nature of what I do and the fact that we're checking things and being so much more controlling with everything, I actually will do a recurrent pregnancy loss workup in patients with two or more biochemicals, just because I think
so that was the other thing.
Really high.
Well, because they're already going through IVF for a reason.
Yeah.
Right. So they're already going through that IVF for a reason. So that might be more of an indication. But my patients, you know, if I'm seeing them, that's usually
totally
not the
different.
Case. Yeah. Yep. It's different. So if you're having multiple chemical pregnancies after 40, is that to be expected? Is it because it's assumed to be chromosomal, or is there something else to look for? That was the question. One of the questions.
Yeah. I would expect or assume that it's probably chromosomal abnormalities, but definitely if you've never had a proper evaluation of your uterine cavity, it can't hurt to just rule, because you could have more than one thing going on. Yes, age is a factor, but you know, it's not fair to just hand wave and ignore all the other possibilities. Like I've had patients in that exact situation who've had a fibroid sitting right in the middle of their cavity. And I'm like, well,
I mean,
I don't know if it was
people
a fibroid.
after 40 deserve an infertility workup as well. And
Exactly.
we can't always assume it's because of age, you know, especially if you've never had a child before, because say you delayed childbearing for whatever, and you are trying for the first time after 40 and you never had a reason to know whether or not you could get pregnant. And then now you're having, you know, whether they're biochemical or other forms of pregnancy loss, we can't just say, oh, you're 40.
Yeah.
That's to be expected, right? We still deserve, you know, that patient still deserves to have the workup that anybody else would.
Yeah.
Is it more likely that genetics could play a role? Absolutely. But that doesn't mean we dismiss everything else.
Well, it's just like patients who have irregular cycles, right?
Right.
They'll come to me and they look at me like I have two heads when I'm like, your husband needs a semen analysis. They're like, but I'm the problem. And I'm like, but he might be as well. You just don't know.
Yeah.
And if we're going to go through the hard work of making you ovulate regularly, we want to know that they're sperm.
Right. Exactly. And this is one that we probably every time we have a live discussion comes up. What can people do to improve egg quality?
So
what can
there's
they
nothing
take? What can
concrete
they,
that I can tell you as a fertility specialist that's going to reverse egg quality changes. Can a healthy lifestyle, quitting smoking, you know, taking vitamins and taking the best possible care of yourself, slow the progression, just like it can slow aging, right? Like if you wear sunscreen, you eat well, you drink water, your skin's going to look better and you're going to age slower than your similarly aged counterparts. That's a fact. That's logic, right? Same thing goes for your ovaries. If you take good care of yourself, and I mean, this isn't to say patients who are struggling with egg quality aren't taking good care of themselves. I want to just put that out there. But if you do everything you can to optimize your health, it's possible that you could slow these changes, you know, compared to what they would be if you weren't using those behaviors. But can you reverse? No, there's no data that you can reverse. And there's a lot of gimmicks out there. And we all know that.
Oh my gosh. What I see on social media, take this concoction, this drink, this whatever, and it'll improve your egg quality. That is all trash. It is not. And I hate it. It's someone who had issues with egg quality.
Yeah.
And I was very healthy. I was.
Yeah.
Great weight, worked out, never smoke or drink. Well, drink a little bit, but I didn't drink my first drink till I was 25. To see those things, I just want to reach through the Instagram box and be like, ah, because it's not fair. And I feel like in a lot of ways, it's kind of predatory against those individuals who are having problems with egg quality. And so what Dr. Segan is saying, especially if you're anticipating delaying childbearing, and now more and more individuals are, because they're choosing to wait to have children, which is absolutely fine. Really be mindful of lifestyle changes and what you're doing, and, you know, just be as healthy as possible. I'm not saying you can't have fun every now and then, you can, but, you know, be as mindful as you can about your diet, and, you know, make sure you don't smoke and things like that. But once egg quality issues have already kicked in, like for me, I mean, there wasn't a whole lot I was going to be able to do to change anything. So someone, and this is a question here, but it just popped up about CoQ10, because I hear that a lot. It's going to improve your egg quality. Is that, so I think we talked about this before. It's probably not going to hurt, but
it's an antioxidant.
We don't know that it's going to help. But it's not going to help. Is there a certain protocol to take for CoQ10 or a certain dosage if you're going to take it?
600 milligrams per day. And it usually comes in like 200 milligram capsules. So people will take it like three times a day. That's what's been studied. And there are some human studies, and there's compelling animal data that has shown maybe a better response, or, you know, a trend towards better pregnancy rates. But there's no magic pill or bullet that's going to reverse egg quality changes.
No.
And I totally agree with everything that you're saying in that it's predatory. Sometimes I've seen even other doctors, and I love them, but like saying in their live description or your post, like, we're going to discuss ways to improve egg quality. That's just a red flag to me. Like, anytime someone says that, I'm like, that's just getting people to click on this or to read this or watch it. But really, you can't offer anything that's truly going to do that.
No. And I mean, it's just biology. And unfortunately, it's a consequence of aging. And, you know, that's why I think educating and empowering people who are anticipating being in the boat that I was in, so that they are armed with as much information and they start thinking about it earlier, is the best preventative measure we have, actually.
Yeah.
You know, you know, talking about it more and making sure those that are approaching that benchmark that, hey, you need to start thinking about, even if you think that you don't ever want to have children, I was one of those. I did not think I wanted to, I thought I would be fine until I met my now husband and I completely changed my mind. So, you might change your mind. So still be aware of the implications of delaying, as you get older on your fertility. Next question is, which is better, a fresh or frozen embryo transfer?
So it depends on the situation. We do a lot of frozen embryo transfers in our field now because it's one of the major reasons why ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome has become less of a problem. It's something that I talk to my patients about way less. It's, in the back of my mind, of course, it can always happen. But the reason why ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, which used to be a major complication of IVF, is less common, one of the major reasons is because a lot of the cycles we do now involve just freezing all the embryos and allowing all those high estrogen levels and that unnatural
To come down,
environment of having, to just come down back to the normal baseline 1 to 2 weeks after the egg retrieval. You get a period, your ovaries go back down to their normal size. And then, in a calm, controlled fashion, put the embryo back into a more natural, stable environment so that when the HCG is produced from what we hope is an early pregnancy, if that transfer works, which we hope it does, that HCG can't continue this cascade where HCG can actually stimulate the ovaries and continue to produce those high levels. And it can wreak havoc on your body if you have hyperstimulation syndrome because it makes your capillaries leaky. So you end up getting really dehydrated, gathering fluid in the abdomen. All of these things sound very scary, but I can assure you they hardly ever happen now because we're not doing bunches of fresh transfers. Back in the day, fresh transfer was the best bet because we didn't know how to freeze embryos well. And there was no reason to really be freezing all of them. We were doing multiple embryo transfers and trying to, really maximize the chance of success because we didn't have good ways of picking the healthiest ones. Now, a lot, I'm not saying that you always have to do genetic testing, but a lot of people are doing genetic testing, which has greatly improved the success. And a lot of other advances have improved the success. And we've been able to put back one healthy embryo at a time. And by doing it in a more natural environment, reducing the risk of OHSS. And it also has been shown in patients who have a high ovarian reserve, so they end up getting really high levels of hormones because they have so many eggs growing. If you do fresh transfers in those patients, in addition to the risk of hyperstimulation syndrome, the overall chance of that embryo implanting is about 10% lower than in a cycle where it's a calm, controlled, natural environment and it's a frozen, thawed embryo. So a lot of people think freezing and thawing the embryo is going to hurt my chances, but it's actually the opposite.
Isn't it
So
crazy how it's totally shifted, like just with technology? Because I remember
I
when I
feel so
trained in.
lucky.
I mean, it's awesome, to think about that, because I did residency in 2000, 2004 in a community-based program. So my faculty were private practice docs. And the number of ovarian hyperstim cases we had in early pregnancy with patients, I remember I got to be a pro at helping manage it because we saw it all the time. And, there were some pretty sick patients. And I'm not saying all cases get that way, but it used to be that way. So the way that we've been able to swing the pendulum a little bit to have it more controlled and hopefully prevent that significant complication is just incredible. And then, just like you said, showing that it helps actually to have that pause can even improve your outcomes is even
Even
more
obstetrical
significant.
outcomes, there's some data that suggests higher risks of preterm delivery with fresh transfers in patients that have had really high estrogen levels because it's a less natural environment. So the placenta probably doesn't get to implant as deeply because the lining of the uterus is less receptive to the embryo in the early stages of implantation. So higher rates of preeclampsia, preterm delivery, like all these other things that you wouldn't think of, even ectopic pregnancy is more likely after a fresh transfer. So large majority are frozen transfers. Reasons I still do a fresh transfer sometimes, if a patient has a very low ovarian reserve and I'm not worried about hyperstimulation, right? And I'm worried that they're not going to have embryos that are available to be frozen. Maybe they've done a cycle before and all of the embryos were very slow growing. In that case, it might be better to just put the best one back on day five and hope for the best. But it's never my first choice.
Okay, we have about 5 more minutes, and this is going to be the last question. And we talked about this before. If you go back to, we did a live discussion on just all things progesterone from fertility through pregnancy.
Yeah, that was
And we
good.
talked about this. It is a really good. I go back because I had we had written everything out, and I used that document a lot to look at things. Okay, so the progesterone test, because this is, you know, this is talking about an early pregnancy, following the numbers, supplementing with progesterone. And the person's asking, what is it? You know, how often do we follow it? What do the numbers mean? And what are the docs looking for? And right. I think that we had talked about, you know, we talked about progesterone deficiency and supplementing with progesterone and whether or not it was beneficial. So just touch on those topics.
Yes. So progesterone is progestation, right? It's, it's helping to support a pregnancy. It stabilizes the uterine lining. It's produced by your ovaries after you ovulate. And basically what happens is when your ovaries ovulate a single egg, that egg gets fertilized, right? And it makes its way to the uterine cavity and implants. When it implants, it starts making HCG. And that's the pregnancy hormone. And that is a signal that goes back to the ovary. And it tells that site of progesterone production, keep going. There's a pregnancy you need to support, right? And so if that HCG signal is weak because there's something wrong with that pregnancy, most often it's chromosomal errors, but maybe there's other reasons, then that's literally going to cause the low progesterone levels. That is usually the direction that things are. People oftentimes look at it backwards and they're like, I had a miscarriage, my progesterone levels were low, therefore, you know, it was the progesterone's fault. And if I had just supplemented with progesterone, this would have supported the pregnancy. But really, it's what came first, the chicken or the egg. A lot of times there's nothing you can do to prevent that miscarriage from continuing in the direction it's going. And throwing progesterone at the problem is not going to modify the outcome. If anything, it might prolong how long it takes to miscarry, and get over it, because it's keeping the lining stable and preventing the breakdown and evacuation of that pregnancy, which is not normal. So I'm not saying that there's never a role for progesterone. You know, certainly we will have a low threshold to give it. If we check someone's levels and they're low, I mean, sometimes we're going to give it because we just want to do everything we can, on the off chance that that is the one rare individual or the, you know, the rare entity where something's wrong or dysfunctional with their ovaries. Of course, there can be underlying medical problems that can lead to an ovary being less likely to produce proper amounts of progesterone, and those should be fixed. Those underlying problems can be corrected. But in and of itself, it's a very, it would be a very rare entity to just have an ovary that doesn't know what it's doing, right? Usually it's the HCG signal and the abnormal pregnancy that's causing those low progesterone levels. Now, when you think about people in my world doing IVF and treatments, those are different patients that require progesterone, because a lot of times if you're doing a frozen embryo transfer, that person didn't ovulate. So we're mimicking that environment, and we need to give them the progesterone, and we can only wean it off and take it away once the placenta has taken over between 7 to 10 weeks of pregnancy.
Yeah. And I feel like it's also an obstetrical field. For OBGYNs, that progesterone is the answer to everything, and that we could just give progesterone without any consequence. And that's not true. We don't know what the long-term effects are on progesterone. And I've heard of docs giving it before they even get pregnant, starting to take vaginal progesterone. There is absolutely no evidence for that at all. And, you know, once a pregnancy, you know, is having a heartbeat and all that, continuing the progesterone with no other indication is not indicated either. You know, you make sure that you're taking it for valid reasons. Because like I said, we don't have the long-term data on if there's anything that could potentially be a side effect of having that exposure to progesterone early. So
if you're taking it while you're trying to conceive too, you might be using it like a birth control, because what people don't realize is there's a very specific window of implantation that is opened up or started timeline wise based on when that progesterone hits your lining. So I've heard of patients who, you know, they just started taking progesterone around the time that they thought they were ovulating. And I'm like, well, that might have totally shifted your window of implantation and made it less likely to work.
Yep, exactly. And, you know, and listen, the best thing to do is be under the supervision of a doc. It's not going to these groups and where they're telling you that they did this and this worked for them, or that, because they're not physicians. And like Dr. Sikhan said, it could actually work against you. So please be mindful of that when you're taking, especially progesterone, because again, I see it all the time that people are taking it like they think it's, you know, it's always going to be good and never be detrimental, when that's simply not true. So we need, and if you anybody wants more information, because we went in detail, in depth about progesterone, and it's underneath my Instagram videos, not the reels, but the videos, and you can listen to that live discussion there. That's all the questions I have for you. Thank you for joining me for this discussion for National Infertility Awareness Week. I think we touched on a lot of really great topics. So I will put all the topics underneath in the caption and also where you can find Dr. Seekon. We do a lot of stuff together, but make sure you go over and follow her because she's very, very, very good and very informative. Thank you for sharing this hour with me on a Tuesday night. I hope you enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you for doing this. This was so great and looking forward to it. I know it won't be the last one.
It will not. We'll talk again soon.
All right, bye. Have a good
Bye.
night.
You too. I hope you enjoyed that discussion. The next episode is an Ask Us Anything session with OBGYN Dr. Erica Montes.